Hello, everyone, and welcome back to SCADcast. Thank you for joining us. I'm Matt Nickley. Today's On Creativity conversation took place live over Zoom as part of SCAD's new Guests and Gusto program, bringing industry leaders to SCAD virtually this spring and summer. Our guest today is a longtime friend of SCAD, leading producer, executive, and head of television at TED, Juliette Blake. Blake's career spans film and television from her days at Nat Geo TV and Jim Henson Television to her producing The 100-Foot Journey alongside Steven Spielberg and Oprah Winfrey. She recently closed a deal to produce another film with Steven Spielberg's company, Amblin Partners, titled Stolen Time. Blake's unbridled passion for storytelling has amplified the muted and accentuated ideas worth sharing all around the world. Her dedication and quest for greater connection have not rested during this pandemic, and we're proud to share her message of strength, positivity, and silver linings. She's mentored countless SCAD students over the years, and now all of you get the benefit of her wisdom. From SCADcast, this is On Creativity, a conversation between Paula Wallace and Juliette Blake.
So, Juliette, I have known you for a long time. We've been friends for a long time. Your daughter and your son-in-law graduated from SCAD, and you've helped us so much with so many of our festivals at SCAD, our SCAD ATV Fest, our SCAD Savannah Film Festival, and you've even mentored students in SCAD Lacoste and just contributed so much to SCAD over the years. And your knowledge really spans so many disciplines that we actually teach at SCAD. So thank you for joining us today.
It's an absolute honor to be with you, Paula. Thank you.
So TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. And there's a lot of communication thrown in there. How would you say that communication is thriving during this time of virtual communication?
I actually think it's an incredibly interesting time to be communicating with people. I mean, you know, we are talking one-on-one right now, and I've been having video conferences that have been deeper than I have ever had in the past. People are reaching out to me that I haven't seen in a long time because they know exactly where I'm going to be. So they know where I am. They know I'm at home. They know that I'm working. But they reach out in an email saying, there's something I want to tell you, or I'd like to discuss something with you. I'm having these conversations that feel like the most creative conversations I've ever had in my life, to be honest.
Amazing. Amazing. And I know with our departments, like our School of Foundation Studies has been having like a daily sketch challenge, and our Fibers department has been doing a daily color palette practice. So there are many opportunities that we've been taking advantage of with this virtual communication. I know, too, a lot of people are working remotely, and you've been working remotely for a very long time. Do you have some tips?
I do. Create an atmosphere that feels good to you. You'll see behind me, I have a collection of portraits. I love art, as Paula knows well. I love books. I have a wall of books here and some wonderful art. And for me, I need to be surrounded by things that mean a lot to me personally. That when I know, I never feel lonely when I have great things around me that make me feel as if I'm a creative spirit. So the first thing I would suggest is to create an environment that you feel comfortable with. You don't have to spend a lot of money on it either. I mean, a lot of these portraits here have been bought for under $50. I mean, I used to have a ceiling on only spending a small amount of money. I know that's a lot for students at the moment, but draw something yourself, paint on the walls yourself. I mean, I think that to work in a creative environment of your own, however small, however large, you know, just create your own personal space, because if you're going to be creative, you need to feel embraced by creativity around you. That's one piece of advice that I would give. And then the other advice that I would give, and I was funnily enough giving this to somebody earlier today, is it's not just about creating your online personality, which I've talked to many of your students about before, but it's about creating your world. You know, if you've watched Saturday Night Live that people did from their homes last week, weren't you just desperately looking at where they were living and what the backgrounds were? I mean, I was so looking at their environments. They kept them very plain. But I want to see if I'm talking to somebody that they're in a creative space or they can show me their garden or, you know. And then the other thing is to communicate with your peers, not just your lecturers, but set up little groups of people. And then another tip that I would have is shine a light on yourself. I have a window in front of me, but I also have a small light to the side of me that I swear maybe takes 5 years off me, which is badly needed at the moment.
So some of the studio productions have come to a halt because you can't have so many people together working in one space right now. But post-production really hasn't slowed down. Voice acting and voiceover narration is very busy. What do you think the short and the long-term implications and impacts for the film and television business are?
Well, I think writers are still writing. Scripts are being written. Animators are animating. I think that the film industry and TV industry is going to go through a massive shift. I know that Netflix have bought in advance probably up to a year. But, you know, there will be a buying frenzy when this is over. I mean, there'll be a buying frenzy and there will be a lot more creativity. So I think that, yes, things are very strange at the moment. But I would say to everybody, use this time to really think about what it is you want to create, who you want to be, what your voice is. And with that, I would also say, be very, very careful what you put on social media. You know, we all talk about building your own brand, but more than ever before, people are looking at you. They're looking at students, they're looking at you, what you're saying on Facebook, although Facebook's very old fashioned now, but, you know, what you have on Instagram, the images that you use, how you're speaking about yourself, speaking about others, speaking about the college experience is super important because people are watching. You know, it's really important that you think about how you want to be perceived publicly.
So you can really archive your ideas right now and then perhaps store up a lot of good ideas that then you might implement later.
Yes, read books. You know, who has the time in our busy lives to sit and read a novel? You know, find new material. I've been sort of looking online for interesting news stories. There's so much information and news about the virus. It's all news about the virus. I watch that or read it once a day and I put it to one side because I think it can become very damaging for our creativity and for our sensibility and who we are as people to become obsessed by that. It's a terrible thing. People are dying. It's heartbreaking, but we have to move forward. You know, we have to move forward with our creativity and think beyond it. That's the job of artists and creators. We have to think what's on the other side of it. You know, where do we go from here?
You're very connected to the creative community across many different disciplines. What recent takeaways are you hearing from the creative community about how we can utilize what's in front of us right now?
I think one of the things that I'm hearing is the importance of connection. You know, it's what Brené Brown talks about. And it's and also about vulnerability. Not everybody's going to feel great on a daily basis. So you can't be creative all the time unless you allow yourself some downtime. Now, for me personally, and I know this is true for many of my colleagues, we travel a lot. You know, I go to India all the time for the TV series that I do there. The fact that I'm rooted in one place for the time being, and I'm able to stay home, has given me a freedom of spirit. And I'm hearing that from other people as well. This week, I've spoken to the author Neil Gaiman, who has created a beautiful piece for something that we're doing at TED next week because we couldn't do our TED conference. So he's created this. It's 3.5 minutes and it's the most, I will actually post it on my Instagram and on my social media in the next few days. But you know, people are creating wonderful content and I think that it's different. There's an intimacy about it. And I think this time is giving us the opportunity to not only look outwards to our creativity, but to think inwards as well, and to think about who we really are. And I'm hearing it from all of my friends and my colleagues at TED. We do a Zoom meeting, we use Blue Jeans at TED, and we do a Blue Jeans meeting every morning where we go around probably 20 people, and it's our group of curators, and we talk about how we're feeling. And it's so important to have community at a time like this, because community breeds creativity. Creativity is not, it is sometimes a solitary thing, but it's often a very much a community thing. We get great joy from going to galleries and to museums, and we pick up the energy of other people looking at art. You know, it's not just all a solitary thing. So find your community and join with them, your friends or other colleagues or professors, you know, and then draw and paint and do things that you wouldn't normally do. You know, there's an opportunity because time has changed, you know. Days have morphed into weekends. People are sleeping longer sometimes, or they're working late at night. I mean, it's okay to do that. And what I'm finding is that people want to share their creativity. You know, there are artists who are drawing in real time and doing an illustration every morning live online. And I watch those. And you can go to digital galleries and museums and art, you know, you can actually walk through art galleries. You can watch a National Theatre play on YouTube. So there's an opportunity from your own home to go to the theatre, to go into an art gallery, to witness things that have never been available to us before. You know, it's a really exciting time, I think.
And you think there's a metaphor in there somewhere?
Yes, I do. And this is go with me on this one. It's quite strange. So the other day, you wear pajamas some days, let's face it, and you're working hard and you have a lot to do, and you put a shirt, just the shirt top on, and you've got your pajamas underneath. I do have trousers on today, by the way. But the other day I was brushing my hair and I went, oh my Lord, look at this. And then I thought to myself, you know what? It's okay. It's okay. This is a metaphor. These dark roots are a metaphor for who is the real me. I haven't seen this person in a long, long time. I get my hair dyed, you know, not that often, but every now and again. And I was thinking, this is going to be interesting. Will I be slightly different? And we're all going through different versions of seeing the real selves. Am I good at being on my own? If you're living in an apartment with anybody else, how do I cope with that? How is my creativity changing? You know, am I going gray? Am I getting ready to transition to the next phase of my life and my creativity? You know, I have this absolute need to do things that are different all the time. I love what I do at TED, but I do like to be thinking in these downtimes as to what would excite me now. Doesn't have to all happen this minute, but I do like to think about new projects. And also I personally get a lot of satisfaction by talking to SCAD students. You know, I spend quite a lot of time interfacing with the next generation of filmmakers. I love nothing more than mentoring people, you know. And last week I was talking to Lucy Artigas, who's one of your students, who's written the most beautiful script that she wanted to go and shoot in Mexico. She can't shoot right now. So we talked about the script. I read it. This is the time when Lucy can add texture to it. So she's written a beautiful script, but now she can visualize it in her mind, you know, before she goes and shoots it. This is a perfect time to take the time to make things even better because you have the luxury of time. If you're painting, if you're drawing, if you're an architectural student, dream big, dream small, but dream. This is the time you have when you're not having to cross town, go on buses, go to lectures. This is, you know, you'll do your home studies, but then there's this additional time, which is, I call it travel time, which is additional time when you can really be, curatorial with yourself, how you want to select things, what you want to read. It's a gift we've got. I mean, of course, it's terrible because this is a virus, no question. But as an artist, thinking about what you want to give to the future of humanity, this is your time.
Time to shine. You have always been a trailblazing female executive before it was cool, a woman in charge at Jim Henson TV, Nat Geo, and TED TV. Very big brands. How do you balance the macro and the micro? How did you figure out how to put TED on TV?
Well, TED has, you know, I always, when I was at National Geographic, I used to use TED to, as a casting, you know, I would look at TED Talks to find people to be in National Geographic TV programs. When I left National Geographic, one of my old colleagues from a previous job had gone to TED. And I went and I met Chris Anderson and I said, why have you never done TED on TV? And he said, you know, it doesn't really work. And we made it work. We made it work with some PBS specials and then lots of content in India. I think when it comes to working with big brands, they're sacred. And you have to find a way of adding to the brand and not taking away from the brand. And as a woman executive working in television and in film, the one thing I would advise is to not be hierarchical, is that some of the best, and I learned this actually from Jim Henson, not that I ever met Jim Henson, but I heard early on in my time there at that company that when he was looking for good ideas for shows and for content and even for characters, he would ask the janitor just as quickly as he would ask a senior vice president. And I'm a really great believer in that. I'm a believer that ideas can come up from ground up. I mean, look at the beauty that comes from the earth. You plant a seed, you don't go and look at the tallest sunflower to find the best ideas. They're already dropping seeds. You look at the earth and the green shoots that come up are usually the ones that bear the most fruit. And right the way through my career, and a very good example of that is when I did the 100-foot journey for Amblin, it was DreamWorks. When I made that film, there was one person who was a director of development there, who was the one person who believed in that project, believed it should happen. Her name was Kira Goldberg. She's now at Netflix as a very senior feature executive there. And she believed in that project and she helped me all the way through. And that book also was written by a first-time author. You know, I'd never made a movie before. It made $90 million, you know. So, and I made that film because I believed in the content and I was like a dog with a bone. I wouldn't let go of it. I just wouldn't let go of it. But the other thing that's important is to have a good work-life balance. And that's always been very important to me. And I don't think you can be fully creative unless you have that. You can't just be a workhorse and work all the time. You have to, you know, you have to take creativity from other places, not just sitting at your desk.
You famously said that everyone has a story. What are some of the hallmarks of a good story, no matter what the medium is? It might be literature, it might be drama, it might be a song, it might be, you know, a film.
The way I look at it is sometimes somebody will tell me a story and I'll think, oh, there's a germ of something brilliant in there. And I may have used this before, but it feels like it's a block of marble and you have to chip away at it. And if you keep chipping away at it, there will be a thing of immense beauty underneath it somewhere. So for me, good storytelling, whether it's in a novel or a true story, or it's how it's told. So if it's a documentary or, and I have had TED speakers who I've been salivating at thinking, oh, this person is so incredible, I want to make a film about them, you know, or here's somebody who, or I'll find a piece in a magazine. This happened to me once a very long time ago. I was living in England. And when I moved to America, I found this old pink folder and it had all these ripped out articles from magazines and things. And I think there may be six in there out of three of them have been made into films. And I missed my moment. And I thought, ha, that's a wake up call, you know. So I think it's just
to yourself.
Yeah. Collect. You know, I think if you hear something that's amazing, put it away, but don't put it away for too long. I find that I'm compelled by things to the point where it drives my husband crazy, by the way, because sometimes I'll see a painting and it can be way out of my price range. And I would rather not buy clothes for a year because I have to have it. You know, and it's the same with a story. If I read something and I think I have to make this film, I will have to make it. I mean, there's just no question. It doesn't always happen, but you know, I will have to pursue it. The film that was just announced last week that I'm doing with Amblin, which is Steven Spielberg's company, it took me 15 months to close the deals on it. 15 months, and we haven't even got a script writer on it yet. So just to get to the point of reading something, falling in love with the material, and then trying to scramble all the deals, you have to have a lot of patience to do that, you know, to actually think, is anybody really going to want to do this? Should I do it? You know, but you just have to believe in yourself and your gut feeling for what a good story is. Yeah.
Patience and persistence. Yes. So we're all looking forward to that. Stolen Time, an adaptation of a memoir. Can't wait to see that. So TED Talks are famously 18 minutes long. What do you think is the magic about that? Or why is that the ideal length for sharing a story? And are there any other tips for good storytelling or talks that you could share with our students?
Absolutely. And I think your students are already great storytellers, or many of them are, or in the time they are at SCAD, I see them progress. You know, sometimes I meet students when they're in their first year, and then I see them grow, and it's so exciting to see what they, I mean, Lucy's a very good example of that, because I met her in La Costa, I think, a couple of years ago, and then I saw her in Atlanta when I was there for the TV festival, and we've, you know, and whenever I see her at SCAD, there are big hugs, and I'm so proud of the work that some of your students do. So at TED, talks are actually shorter now. I mean, some are 18 minutes. Most of them are about 12 minutes. Some of them are even 3 or 4 minutes. And I'm actually fascinated by short form as long as longer talks, because it's harder to get, you know, when you've got a lot of time to tell a story, you don't have to be quite so concise. But when you've got a really short amount of time to tell a story, then it's much harder. For me, if you can tell that story in a log line, then you know you're onto something. So there was one speaker from India, and the log line for her talk was, don't give poor advice to poor people. Another teacher from Brownsville, which is the most dangerous area of New York, her opening line was, I opened a school to close a prison. You know that that's a powerful thing, right? You know that something incredible is going to come after that. So you have to think about structure. You have to think about the beginning, the middle, and an end. And they have to be in that order. And they're not always in that order. You know, sometimes I'll read a first draft of a TED talk, and the best bit is in that last paragraph, and I immediately move it to the front, you know? So I think it's knowing how to edit yourself. And also to think, just because you think you're fascinating doesn't mean to say anybody else is going to. So what is it about that story that you believe is going to interest other people? What is the idea that's worth spreading? That's our log line at TED, you know. Mm-hmm. And they don't all have to be intellectual. I mean, yes, there are some amazing people doing incredible scientific innovation. There's some great business talks and design talks. But, you know, you can do it, have a very personal subject that's very, very dear to your heart, that can be an extraordinary talk, you know.
Yeah, that individualism sometimes then applies to so many people's lives and stories. Mm-hmm. As you're looking at other new projects, what captures your attention?
I'm always fascinated by justice, by human rights, by stories of immigration, by stories of heroism, but not in the traditional sense. You know, when I read The 100-Foot Journey, to me, and the novel is a thin book. It was a novella to begin with. I actually have the original. Anyway, I have many books here from many projects that I'm either planning or hoping to do in the future. But, you know, what appealed to me about the book initially was that it was about a family of immigrants. And I'm from a family of immigrants. And, you know, when I made Border Wars with a huge team at National Geographic, that was about people crossing borders. And to me, the book was about the clash of cultures. And I'm fascinated by subjects like that. So I'm always looking for things. I'm not always aware of why something appeals to me. Sometimes I'll hear a story from somebody and it'll resonate with me, like this woman yesterday who was telling me about this shaman. you know, working in the rainforest. And I said, oh my goodness, he'd give a great TED talk. And she said, he's very private. You go to him, he doesn't come to you, you know. And I was like, okay, well, maybe we could go to the rainforest and capture a TED talk from him at some point, not now. But, you know, I feel very blessed that I meet such amazing people, including so many amazing SCAD students. You know, that is the thing. You guys at SCAD are the storytellers of the future. There is no doubt in my mind about that.
Thank you. Thank you, Julia. Well, I don't know what the results of our poll are, but, you know, maybe we can look. Oh, the poll results are in. And our students would like to hear more about TED.
Oh, good.
Advice, maybe some coaching or some anecdotes of people that you have coached who had a good idea, but you really helped them to formalize it into a good talk.
Well, I think one of the surprising things for speakers is that, well, there are many different kinds of TED speakers. There are speakers who give a lot of talks, and they're used to giving talks, and they think that they'll write their talk, and then we'll say, wow, this is amazing. We love it. Yes, come and give a TED talk. That's not quite how it always works. TED, we pride ourselves on really getting intimate talks out of people. So what we want to do is to have something from them that has not been heard before. We ask them not to sell things, not to orate like they're making a marvelous speech. They should be much more conversational. So one of my favorite stories is about a woman called Rita Pearson. I was making TED's first ever TV program, and we were shooting it in Brooklyn, and it was a program on education. And I was very much looking for somebody. I had nearly all the speakers in place. There was Bill Gates, there was Sir Ken Robinson, and I wanted to have a really strong, fantastic woman. And I wanted to have somebody who, I really had somebody in my mind's eye. I wanted an educator who was warm, who was going to give a really important talk about the relationships between a teacher and their students. And what I did was I went on YouTube, I looked for somebody, and I found somebody who was a preacher and an educator, an amazing woman called Rita Pearson. And it took me 3 months to track her down. And when I did, I got her on the phone. She was from Houston, Texas. And I said, Rita, I've been looking for you. I've seen you on YouTube. I'm Juliet Blake. I'm head of television for TED. And she went, who's TED? And I thought, this is perfect. Here's somebody who is unaware of the fact TED exists. So she's not going to orate and want to sell a book or a movie deal. Here's somebody who is an absolutely authentic educator. And that's the key for me, is authenticity. If you're not authentic and your talk doesn't come from the heart, or something that you are, a story or a piece of work that you've done or an idea that you have that you're burning to talk about in a really authentic way, then we can smell it a mile away. You know, we really, authenticity is hugely important for what we do at TED. And we're always looking for real people doing really interesting, real things. You know, it doesn't have to be people who've already been featured in a magazine or in a movie or in a book or have written papers. We look for, my passion is to find people who are doing extraordinary things and have extraordinary stories, but are not well known already.
Absolutely. You're the discoverer. So we're now going to open things up for students from our questions from our students or viewers. And let's see who has some questions. And I see one from Natasha Sakira, Film and Television MFA. At a time when Indians in Hollywood films were primarily showcased for comedic relief, you produced a film, The 100-Foot Journey, that showcased the warmth and genuine culture of the race. What was it like bringing that to the world?
I would say one of my happiest and best experiences. You know, Om Puri, who played Papa in the film, first of all, sadly, he died a few years ago, the most brilliant actor.
Brilliant.
Right. And he was so authentic. And when we screened the film, you know, you do a test screening and you invite a bunch of people to watch the film. And I said, you know, we need to have a lot of Indians in the audience to make sure that that the film is appealing to the Indian people. So we did a test screening in Pasadena. And there were large Indian families that had come to the screening. And I was very excited to see them because I'm, you know, passionate about India. And when I saw their reaction and how they were laughing at him because he spoke some lines in Hindi, and I was like, oh my goodness, these are jokes I didn't even know were in the film, you know. And then one of the executives said, you know, we need to subtitle the film. And I said, absolutely not. I said, there's no way, because, it, you know, if you subtitle it, it feels to me like it's a little bit patronizing. Let this audience work for multiple different audiences on a different level. And I didn't have to fight, but I was so happy that we didn't subtitle it, because I really felt strongly that, you know, it was a movie that we tried really hard to make it culturally correct without it seeming fake or false, or my word, authentic. I wanted it to be absolutely authentic, even down to the shoes that people were wearing and how they ate and what they were eating. You know, a lot of time and energy went into that. It was a marvelous experience for me.
We had a couple of French chefs on the set and a couple of Indian chefs to make sure that everything was accurate about the food too.
Yeah, we did.
There's another question from Olivia Schneider, film and television major. I'm an aspiring producer entering the industry myself. What specific traits do you think make for a successful producer?
Being unflappably calm, really good under pressure, hugely patient, and always being kind to people. It sounds like such a strange thing to say, because the producers have to be tough in some ways, but you also have to realize that everybody has a really difficult job to do on a movie. And as the producer, your role is to, you know, sometimes it's to put all the money together. Sometimes it is to work alongside the studio if you're doing a studio picture, or if you have a lot of investors, then you have to work with the investors. But everything is in service of the director. The director who is at the helm of your film is God. This is my own personal view. And that as a producer, you have to protect the director so that they can do the best possible job that they can do.
Mahalia Latortue asks, the 100-foot journey with both shot in France and India, what is it like producing internationally and what challenges did you face?
Well, it was a wonderful experience. You know, that was a big film. I mean, it for me, it was a big film. it's a big film by many people. But you know, it wasn't a Star Wars movie, but you know, we had an amazing crew in France. It was partly, the crazy thing was, is that we had a Swedish director and a Swedish DP. We had a French crew and an English crew. So there were three languages being spoken at all times. But, you know, we were working in the most beautiful environments. When we were shooting in India, I'd never been to India before, you know, and it was a wake-up call, you know, where traffic is stopped because cows are walking on the freeway, where you're filming in a market, a very authentic market, the opening of the movie where you see the little Hassan running through the market with his mother. That was a real market. We were there all day. But you know, if you want something to be authentic, you have to make it authentic and you have to do it for real rather than setting up fake markets and all of that. I'm all about realism in film.
Lucy Artigas, film and television senior, says, these are weird times for the world. So I would like to know your advice for recent film graduates that are looking to join the industry. Where should we go? If New York and LA have been so greatly impacted by the COVID-19 crisis, do you think the industry will seek to restart operations in places less affected by the virus?
I think that's an absolute possibility. I mean, Lucy, I know you well, and you know how talented I think you are. I think that, you know, there will be more films. Look, the virus has affected the whole world. It's not just in New York and Los Angeles. I think that there is I live in Austin, Texas now. There is a budding, beautiful film community happening here. and with film studios being built not far from here in Bastrop. I mean, there are extraordinary things happening in other communities. And I think it will be good for the film industry if it isn't just so coastally, set up. I do think that there are things happening, pockets of great filmmaking. Look at what's happening in Atlanta. There's so much filmmaking happening there. It's going to happen all over the, if we could spread it out around the country. And look at the great Mexican filmmakers, Lucy. I mean, there are so many interesting things happening around the world. I think it's going to be slow for a little bit, but by the time you've finished your senior film and you've shot your film, I'm talking very directly to you now, Lucy, in Mexico, you're going to have such a piece of beauty to share with people. I'd be surprised if you don't get snapped up.
Haley's asking, hi, Juliet. How did you know that you wanted to be a producer? What made you decide on producing instead of directing, for example? Or how did you your journey as a producer begin or play out?
My sister, who was 17 years older than me, was a costume designer. She won an Academy Award when I was 14. And I felt, I'm leaving the film business to her. I will work in television on radio. So I started in radio and TV. And it wasn't until I read The 100-Foot Journey that I decided that I wanted to actually make a film. And my sister couldn't have been more proud of me. She came to the premiere. She was in awe of the fact that I'd produced a movie. For me, I'm a good organizer. I don't actually love being in front of the camera. My passion has always been to help other people tell their stories. I mean, Richard Moraes, who wrote The 100-Foot Journey, when I went to meet him and I'd read the book and I said, please let me option your book. He said, but you've never made a film before. And I said, but I will get this done and I will involve you every single step of the way. I actually think that, other people, if you're passionate about something as a producer, you have the ability to make things happen, and they can happen in the most extraordinary different ways. So for me, it was my entry point wanting to make, I like to make things happen, and I honestly don't necessarily like to make them happen just for myself. I like to help them happen for other people, which is why I love mentoring so many of your students,
That's the joy of being an educator, is just experiencing being a part of someone else's joy in life.
Well, President Wallace, you do it so brilliantly. I mean, to pay you a compliment for, because it's all about these people that you interview, but I've never known, I went to university twice. I did a postgraduate and I did an undergraduate, but I never had somebody like you at the helm of an organization. I mean, I had professors that I thought were great, but the way you have this current situation with, what's happening in the world is remarkable, and you lead from the front in a very creative way, and I'm very inspired by the way you do it.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. Jenny Kula asks, in the 100-foot journey, what is the benefit of cultural fusion? What are your thoughts on the creative possibilities of cultural collision in our current global economy?
I fear it greatly. I mean, I do think that many stories are going to be about this very subject, and I think that I don't want to talk about politics. No good can come of that. But I do fear that there is going to be a lot of haves and have-nots, as there's always been. It would be the have-nots that I would be the most excited to make stories with. I feel that there's going to be a lot of cross... calling the virus the Chinese virus. I'm not being political here. Doesn't help. I think that it's up to us to tell beautiful stories about beautiful people, whatever their race and whatever their creed. And I think this is a very, very important time to think about those cultural clashes and cultural differences and to tell those stories. There are very hard-hitting things in the 100-foot journey. You just have to find them. I mean, when Madame Mallory Helen Mirren asks her chef to sing the Marseillaise, that's very much a political statement. That is talking about, an element of racism that was felt by the Indians in that movie. I mean, it's in there, but it's told beautifully and it's not done in a heavy-hitting way. So I'm all about telling those stories, and I hope that some of you are too. It's important. It's important that we tell the stories of people who are, let's give a voice to the voiceless in our work.
Pankti Thattar says, I'm a transfer student from India, an architecture major. I'd like to know what it's like to be at TED. I do know there are so many people who dream to talk at TED. What would you like to tell them? Do you have a message for them?
You know, we've had some wonderful talks on architecture at TED. You know, we get 25 and 30,000 people that log onto our website to recommend somebody. You can recommend yourself to give a TED talk when you're ready. Don't try and give a TED talk too soon. Again, we do review all of those. You know, my advice would be to start off with TEDx or even TED-Ed, you know, TED-Ed lessons. If you go onto our TED-Ed website and take a look at those animated talks, they are beautiful. Don't have to start by giving a main stage TED talk. There are many other ways of getting involved in TED, either through TEDx or TED-Ed and having your voice heard. And don't think about 13, 12 minute talks. Think about short talks and do get involved with your TEDx community. I know that there is one in Savannah for sure and in Atlanta.
I'm an alum from the SCAD class of 2006 film and television, and working in the past and now in your upcoming film project with Amblin and working closely with Steven Spielberg. What is the collaboration like with an extremely creative individual such as Steven? That's from Josh.
Well, he's an extremely busy man. And, you know, he has multiple projects. So he's also the most visual thinker. He just has this extraordinary brain and you can see it working. I mean, he's a genius. I mean, I feel just to be in a room with him is remarkable, and to see how he thinks filmically. I mean, I've watched every film he's ever made. I mean, he knows that Schindler's List changed my life. I mean, it literally changed my life. He comes to TED now nearly every year with his wife and sometimes some family members. And, you know, he's a genius. He's an absolute, and you don't meet that many geniuses, although actually I do meet quite a few at TED. But, you know, he has such a visual brain. It's a gift.
Eleanor asks, our students are Zooming their pitches and interviews these days. What are your tips for winning others over without being able to read the room?
Well, you should be able to read the room. You know, if you are in close up and you are, I mean, it's important to look at, I'm looking into the camera quite a lot of the time, but I'm now looking at Paula and I can see Paula's beautiful chair and I can see the plant and I can see she's engaged and that she's smiling, you know, and then I'm looking back at the camera because you want to be communicating with the person that you're trying to speak to. So I think it's really important to have your story straight before you begin. In the same way that with a TED talk, you know, I opened a school to close a prison. What's your opening line? When they say, tell us about yourself, what are you going to say? Try and practice with somebody beforehand. Do it with your mum, do it with a girlfriend, boyfriend, significant other. It's so important that you use that time in a really productive way. And the most important thing is to listen. So it's not just about you. You know you're only going to have a limited amount of time. So use the time sparingly and listen. Absolutely. Listen to the questions that they're asking. Don't rush into your answer. You're allowed to think about it. It's the same way in a TED talk. If you lose your way, we say to speakers, you know what? It's okay to think for a minute on the stage, because what feels like a lifetime to you feels like a matter of seconds to the person on the other end. You don't have to rush everything. Let them have their moment. Let them tell you, ask them questions. You know, it doesn't all have to be about you. You need to be shown to be a collaborator as well as a clever person.
Jody, I think this is our last question. We have time for one more. I teach business here at SCAD. Could you share what you feel our amazing creative students need to keep in mind when gaining support and or networking for success or pitching ideas?
I mean, one of the things that I would advise is starting at the bottom. I mean, no job is too small. I still make tea for people on my team. I don't expect people to do stuff that I wouldn't do. I'm the first in and I'm the last out, even when I'm working from home. So you have to put the work in. I think your social footprint is crucial these days. Don't put mean-spirited stuff on the internet about anybody or anything. It's not worth it. Even if you're angry about something, don't do it. My advice to you is to try and really figure out. I've never had a five-year plan. I've never had a one-year plan. I've had passion. I've had passion for things that I really want to do and are important to me. And I've written them in a little book, and I've looked, you know, further down the line. Many haven't happened. But the thing is to follow your gut and to do it with good humor and with humility and with authenticity.
Write notes to yourself.
Yes.
You've had such a long and illustrious career, and you've gained so much respect from so many people who want to work with you again and again. And you've shared your mentorship with our students. You mean so much to them, Juliet. Thank you for talking to us today about beauty, about innovation, and about the complexities of telling human stories. Thank you so much, Juliet.
Well, thank you. And I can't tell you how much your students mean to me. I get probably more from them than they get from me, but, and that's the truth. So thank you so much for today.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed hearing from Juliet Blake. You can listen to past TED Talks and engage with the larger TED community at TED.com. Juliet's message reminds all of us how inspiration can strike at any time when we surround ourselves with art, literature, and culture we connect with. We're not always ready to pursue an idea when it presents itself, but great ideas should never be wasted. If you don't already, keep a journal. It doesn't have to be extensive, just a place where you can plant the seed of an idea to come back to when you're ready. Thank you for tuning in to SCADcast and On Creativity, executive produced by SCAD president and founder Paula Wallace, with original music by SCAD alumnus George Lovett. On behalf of the entire SCAD community, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay active. We'll see you next time.